Here's my plan, right? We're going to deliver our squirt virus and Nikita's email, right? It's going to live on their mail server until the admin's clever enough to read it. At that point, we're going to exploit his time. Pretty good plan. Connect back shellcode out to us, listening on the public internet. Going to escalate some privileges, drop our nicely prepared rootkit. And then from there, we'll Trojan his SSH up good and proper, sniff his keystrokes, wait till he logs in the database server. Yeah, it's all good, right? All good. Those didn't look like email addresses when I wrote it. Alright, anyway, so, got a brand new Pine Zero Day, run it through our mail spoofer, send him something he's got to read, right? I mean, that looks like a compelling piece of email to me. And we fire up our netcat, and we hang around. You notice for convenience that's on 41337 instead of 443, but never mind. And look at that shell, right? Pine Squirt worked perfectly. Yep. You are the admin? Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's a clever man, nice username. Oh, shit. Where does Pine go? Nah. Ah, look. Damn thing dropped call, right? He's probably going to notice that. He's sitting there using his Pine. Bam. All gone. Ah, shit. So at this point, you know, he's probably going to spot us. Hacksaw.com, pretty poor choice of reverse, I now admit. And, yeah, look at that. He started above shell. He's going to start rummaging around where we're going. Ah, shit. Now, if you're a clever man, you know, if you're a wise man, it's time to drop carrier, right? Plus, 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 ADH more, just get the hell out of here, right? Things have gone horribly wrong. Ooh. Apparently, pear-shape doesn't translate well into North American English, you know, terribly sorry about that. But yeah, did you see that in the PS output back there? Look, SSH session root at their name server. That sounds pretty good, huh? Pretty good. I'd like that. If I drop carrier now, right, I'm never going to get a chance like that, right? That man, I really, really, really wish there was a way I could get to the other end of that SSH session. It's authenticated. It's already root, right? I don't even have to goddamn root the box. All I got to do is get down that SSH session, man. Only there was a way. Like fucking duh, there is. Which is why I'm standing here. So, yeah, I smack a few magic keystrokes, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, some bang. Bangity bang bang. SSH jack. Do-do-do-do-do-do. Just like that. Anyway, yeah, so my name's Metalstorm. My mum calls me Adam, funnily enough. I'm from New Zealand, which is why I sound a little fucked up. For those of you who are not familiar, right, it's a very small island with kind of like less people than any city in the entire North America. And yeah, we have lots of sheep and apparently hobbits. I haven't seen any, right, there aren't. Let me tell you right now, there are no hobbits. Right? There's no hobbitses. They don't have preciouses. They don't exist. You sad, sad Tolkien fanboys. See, I work for a Linux integrator. I don't actually do much security for a living, so I'm kind of here in a personal capacity, which is why I can say fuck. In the past, I've been a corporate or security consultant. I've done network engineering. I've done all sorts of stuff. So right, what the fuck? What the fuck did we just do, right? We saw ourselves a pretty classic intrusion, right? Slightly different modus operandi than you're probably used to, right? Server boxes was pretty well secured. Instead of attacking the server directly, I decided that the best way to do it is to attack the admin's desktop and then from there to the server. Because desktops, right? I mean, Linux desktops, just as much as Windows desktops, there's a whole bunch of complexity, right? We don't have Clippy, but we do have, you know, lots of candy and enlightenment and things that make your desktop look real pretty. And all that complexity, all that kind of intellectual candy floss that's there to rot your brain, right? That's where all the bugs are. So I want to root up someone's big Linux server, right? I'm not going to go after the server. It's got intrusion detection all over the place and intrusion prevention, like it works. I'm going to go attack the desktops, right? That's where it's at. And certainly people who have Linux desktops, right, they're real geeky. Right? They have glasses and long hair and Unix beards and shit, right? And they look after all the good stuff. So that's where you're going to go. But sometimes, right, sometimes you're not perfect, right? Things go wrong. In that particular case, you know, we got there, we got busted, we dropped core, he's going to notice. So, you know, you can drop carrier like some sort of little pansy. Or maybe you do something a little different, display some adaptability, something a little new. So what are we doing, right? When you hack something, what do you do? What are your goals? Well, generally privilege escalation. That's pretty important. And why is it important? Generally because it's the only way you can get in there and kind of consolidate yourself, make yourself stealthy. When you root a box, you're probably going to be there for a little while because you have to do a bunch of reconnaissance. You have to figure out what you want to do next. Very rarely do you ever, you know, just get root on the box you want. People don't give you out root shells in the database boxes, you know, quite as often as they used to. So yeah, you have to do reconnaissance, right? You're usually on your way. There's kind of another thing you could do, right? You could do it guerrilla style, right? You walk in there, you get what you want, you get the hell out real fast. And that saves you a bunch of time and effort. And I like displaying adaptability, right? That's a big difference between all you fuckers and the people they pay to do this for a living. At least the cheap ones, anyway, I don't know. So this is just a really big name for rooting other stuff instead of the stuff you got. Cross-host privilege escalation, right? So privilege escalation is pretty normal. You have a user account, you want to get some root. That's good. I think root on another box is just as good as root on this box most of the time, right? And local root, you know, it can be a distraction. You know, you're on your way to somewhere. You don't have time to sit around and root could a box up good and drop it. You know, local vulnerabilities are easy to exploit often, right? We have a lot more information, what specific versions, stack layout. We know what we're getting ourselves into. And it can be kind of tempting to sit around and escalate your privileges because you feel good about it, right? You know, you're achieving something, you see a little hash pop out, it's all good, right? You feel good about yourself. And easy is good, I like easy, but what if there was something easier than local privilege escalation? Trust relationships. Yeah, it's kind of old school, I know. You know, people got up here, must be, what, like 5, 6, 7 years ago talking about trust relationships. It's kind of old school, yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, even the other hosts, and back when ports were 1024, were just magically root. Back when people exported /read/write to the entire world. I mean, that was good, right? We're just a bunch of long-haired Unix hippies, right? We love each other. It's all good. We just share. You know, my disk space is your disk space. It makes you feel good, right? It's old school. You know, you feel like your mummy's tucking you up in bed. No, it's good. It's good. But we called that hacking, right? That's just embarrassing, right? That wasn't hacking. That was just mounting stuff. How many of you watched, was it Unauthorized Access, where Simple Nomad goes, like, mount, and he's a hacker? Sorry, if you're in the room, sorry. That's my favorite thing about trust relationships. Instant gratification, right? You turn up, there's a trust relationship between hosts, right? It's like Christmas. It's good. Right now, you get root on another box, or shell on another box. It's great, right? It makes you feel really good. Traditional trust relationships, right? I call them non-transient trusts for no reason other than that I'm obviously about to talk about transient trusts. So that's what I'm calling traditional kind of fixed trusts. Things like R-hosts, things like SSH key-based trusts. They're trust relationships that exist kind of as stored authentication credentials, what Bruce and I would probably call one-factor authentication. Or it can be authentication based on properties of the connection, you know, the source address, the port being below 1024, that sort of thing, right? That's your traditional run-of-the-mill garden trust relationship. this trust relationship, which is transient, which trust relationships that exist only for a period of time. And generally, the most interesting class of those is post-authentication connections. Once you've initially carried out your authentication, the remainder of that session is effectively a transient trust relationship between the hosts. Unless you personally authenticate every single packet you send, then you have to accept some sort of transient trust relationship between hosts. A couple of methods, the traditional methods for exploiting trust and transient trust relationships. And to do so, I picked a couple of metrics just out of the air. Right? How easy it's going to be to do it, how sneaky it is, how stealthy, how close to right the fuck now you can do it, and an overall kind of feeling of feasibility, right? Because an attack's no use if you're only going to be able to use it one time in 100. So yeah, we're going to evaluate them, and for the purposes of this, we're just going to assume that we've got a non-root shell on a box. Right, so your traditional non-transient trusts, right? It's pretty straightforward. Our job is to impersonate the credentials that are used to authenticate that connection for trust, whether it be by coming through the trusted box, using stored key material like with SSH trusts, or by spoofing. And that's pretty straightforward, right? That's easy. Everyone knows that. It's pretty sneaky, right? No one knows that you turned up, saw that it was a trust, and abused it, right? It's pretty damn good. When? Yeah, right now, right? You turn up, you find a trust, you're gone. It's all good. But overall feasibility, yeah, it's not so good, right? How often do people still rely on ports being below 1024, right, outside of, like, bank environments or whatever? Not that often, unfortunately. So you don't see this, which is a pity, because I like it. Right, the other interesting way to attack a transient trust relationship, the traditional way of doing it, if you will, is the key log, right? So during authentication, you log the user's input, either by trojaning SSH, having it listen to your keystrokes, or by logging it from a keyboard with a hardware keylog, or whatever the hell, right? Or even shoulder surfing, right? Something old school like that. So you steal the credentials, and then later on, you reuse them for your own good. Right? Classic technique. Easy? Hell yeah. Everyone does it, right? It is the standard way of getting from one box to another. Right, stealthy, sure, you do it right. You rootkit the box up, you trojan it, all good. When, this is the downside of this, is you have to wait for them to log back in, right? And say, like in our example earlier on, right, you're about to get busted. So if you now go ahead and kill their SSH client, they're not going to reconnect, right? They're wondering where the fuck Pine went. So yeah, that's not so good. Overall feasibility, though, it's a really good technique, right? It's kind of the gold standard. It's what everyone does. You can always fall back on a key log, right? It's all good. Right, man in the middle, right? Similar sort of thing, except that we impersonate the server to the client and the client to the server. We sit in the middle, we grab the authentication credentials. Optionally, if it's encrypted, we have a little bit of jiggery pokey with fake certificates, fake host keys, that sort of thing. And then later on, we can either sniff their connection, see what they're doing, and if we're feeling particularly nasty, we can take it over. Now, the downside of that is, of course, the user's probably going to notice. So, ease. It's a relatively well understood sort of thing. It's not wildly complicated. The downside is, as people deploy PKI systems, or at least look at their host keys, which I hope you do, it's not so good. Stealthy, yeah, same thing, right? SSH pops up huge mongous warnings saying, oh look, someone has messed with your host key, it might be bad. When, same problem, right? We have to wait until authentication time to do it. But overall feasibility, yes, it's okay, right? We can do this occasionally. Now this is a kind of old school, right? The TCP hijack attack, right? You take a running open post-authentication connection, and you bust open some sequence numbers, and you hijack it, right? This is old school. It's been used quite famously by Mr. Kevin Mitnick. But unfortunately, when you go and do it, oh yeah, the users notice, and look at them. That does look like Shimomura, don't you think? He looks pretty pissed. He's got two exclamation marks next to him. That's how you tell. So yeah, E's these days not so good. People have decent, hopefully, random number sequence generation. And yeah, it's not so stealthy. But the plus side, right, it has all the properties we're looking for, right? We can do it right now, right now. Open connection, it's got the credentials we want at the other end, we can go and steal it, all good. But the downside is, yeah, overall feasibility, not so good, right? You're going to need raw sockets, you're going to need promiscuous interface to try and see the sequence numbers if you're not going to be doing it blind. Doing it blind these days is not as easy as it used to be. So yeah, I like it, right? I'd like to be able to do this, but it's not always feasible. But this is the fun one. So, after we've authenticated the session, we turn up on the user's box, and we sneak down their running connection from inside their box. And they don't notice. That sounds easy. It is. It sounds stealthy. It is. It sounds like you could do it right now. And is it feasible? Well, the code's on your CD. What? Yeah, hijack the application. Why not, right? It is slightly different, right? It demands slightly different methodology, right? When you're going to hack someone. Normally, you hack them, you know, on a public holiday, on a weekend, you know, when they're getting married, something like that. Here, what you're interested in is maximizing the number of open post-authentication sessions for you to sneak down. So really what you want to do is you want to turn up during peak time, right? The middle of the day when everybody's right there at their desks. And then you want to sneak in and take their route right out from under them without them noticing. Right, just daylight robbery. And the funny thing is, right, it's not even that difficult. Right, this is just a party trick. I mean, all I did, right, was I thought, you know, there's a lot to be learned from kind of old school DOS viruses. There's a lot to be learned from things we've done in the past. And this is just creative reapplication of the same tricks that, you know, binary reverse engineers and virus writers and all those sort of, you know, kind of sneaky fuckers I've been doing for a while. Right, so I took those numbers that I just pulled out of my ass earlier on, and I put them on a graph to make it kind of look legitimate. And as this graph clearly demonstrates, right, my technique is wildly better than everything except classic trust relationships, which you'd have to be a retard to deploy, right? I mean, seriously. So yeah, I graphed them, and really the conclusion from this graph is that transient trust relationships, exploiting them, is almost as much fun and as easy as exploiting traditional trust relationships. So, for your hijacking pleasure, I present to you my SSH jacker. It doesn't actually look like that, right? You don't need to clap, but it looks different. It looks like a script and stuff. So yeah, it's a Python script, which, when pointed at an SSH session, gives you a shell at the other end. Just like that. So we're going to talk about, briefly, how it works. A few kind of implementation details, but a nitty-gritty stuff, so you can do it yourself. And then we're going to diverge briefly into considering anti-forensics whilst implementing it and using it. And then there'll be like one slide of mitigation, you know, just the responsible bit of the talk. And then, so yeah, we'll talk about a few other bits and pieces that you might have up your sleeves or I might have up mine. Control L, you reckon, huh? Full screen. Hey, that's pretty futuristic. Really? Control L, you say? I'm not familiar with this commercial software with the two buttons and stuff. I'm kind of a one-button sort of guy. Hey, that's pretty sweet. Hey, man, I just hack your network, right? I don't do presentations. So, yeah, SSH, right? For those of you who aren't familiar, which probably isn't anybody, I guess, SSH provides this virtual channel metaphor, right? Effectively, SSH provides a multiplexed transport, right? You can run multiple sessions across a single encrypted TCP pipe, right? And it provides a number of useful things for you to connect to those sessions. The typical ones you'll see is your TTY, Apparently that's pronounced titty, I'm not sure. A shell for you to talk to on the other end of your titty. And, of course, TCP sockets is the other thing we normally shunt around. X connections, that sort of thing. Things over TCP. People are quite familiar with that. So what we're trying to do here, of course, is we want to be able to take the user session away from him and use his credentials, but we don't want him to notice, right? And this sort of virtual channel metaphor is exactly what we're looking for. So how's it work, huh? Well, we're going to take the features provided by SSH, and we're just going to use them for evil, right? That's what hacking's all about, right? So what we do is we ask for a second shell. We say, hey, server, I'm Bob, I'm authenticated. You saw that earlier, right? I gave him my password. I'm good, right? You want to give me another shell? Mm-hmm. I can go another one. Maybe two. And then we're going to glue it to the hacker. Give him a socket. Connect it up. Oh, look, a shell. Just like that. So, using Python and a little bit of debug trickery, we go ahead and we ptrace attach to the client process. Now, this implies, obviously, that you need to be able to ptrace attach. So, obviously, you have to be root, or you have to be running as the same user. Right? And that's not as stupid as it sounds. You think about all the Firefox bugs we've had lately, right? Admins who run Linux on their desktop are almost always going to run Firefox. There's been a few Firefox kind of zero-day run code sort of bugs. You turn up on the desktop, you find every running SSH connection, you jump down them. And then we just rummage around, and we find ourselves the virtual channel setup code, SSH session to open, if you're wondering. All right, and then we just go ahead and patch it. Mm-hmm. So instead of talking to the user, it talks to us. And then we run it. And then we just put everything back like nothing ever happened. Except that the shell just popped out my netcat. So yeah, this is, I like to think, this is the sort of thing that your mother warned you about, right? Hackers, we're sneaky. Sneaky. Well, one of you guys is sneaky. The guy earlier on, yeah. Yeah. Right, we don't just install LRK4 anymore, you know, just Trojan ourselves LS and stuff, right? That's kind of boring. And we don't install BNC, because who cares about IRC? That's right, IRC's crap. Except the older ones get caught, they're always running egg drop bots and crazy shit like that. And yeah, good hackers, a little bit of creativity here and there, maybe they'll do something new and interesting like jack your SSH connections. And if you hire some pen testers and they're good, maybe they'll do it too. So all we're really doing here, it's just automated debugging, right? It's not crazy. It's not rocket science, right? And of course, if you give me a debugger and one of your processes that happens to be doing something important, of course I can fuck with it, right? That's normal. That's what debuggers do. And humans with debuggers can do sneaky things. But what we really want is we want to automate it, right? We want the sneakiness of a human and the speed and portability of a script. So that's what we do. So we're using Python, we're using GDB, gluing them together, and we've come up with effectively an automated debugging toolkit. Of course, one of the downsides about this, and you know, if you've done any binary reverse engineering, is that debugging binaries when you don't have any symbol information is not really debugging, right? It's not fun anymore. So you have to do a kind of a bunch of tricks that normal reverse engineers, people who are doing binary analysis, have to do. And we'll talk a little bit about that in a second. So yeah, the nitty-gritty implementation details. Right, a little bit about Python, about GDBMI. One of the things we have to do is we have to find a safe place that we're going to stop the program and kind of mess with its execution flow, because obviously we can't just go, you know, wildly executing code in its memory space and hope it's going to work. And then we have to find the code we're going to run. We have to execute that code. Or we have to inject some code there first, obviously. And then we have to put it all back again. And, of course, what I'm discussing is in specific reference to my SSH jacker, but it's equally applicable to anything that you're doing this sort of stuff to. And we'll talk about a few of the other interesting things you could do later. So yeah, GDB is the GNU debugger, for those of you who aren't familiar with it. I'm sure you've heard of Richard Stallman, right? He writes some good stuff. One of them happens to be a debugger. It's pretty cool. And GDBMI is its programmatic interface. GDBMI is actually pretty suck. It's about half implemented, but it's good enough. So yeah, I went ahead and just wrote some Python bindings for it. Implements, you know, pretty basic functionality, but enough to get the job done, right? So the SSH client, as you normally use it, is single-threaded, right? It doesn't expect to be running other code in the middle of other code. So yeah, and there's, you know, there's all sorts of kind of nasty global data structures and arrays of function pointers and shit like that, right? So we have to be a little careful about what we're doing. It's also completely asynchronous. So when we ask for that virtual channel, it doesn't get set up right there. It goes in a queue with a list of packets that have to be sent to set it up, and there's a whole kind of, you know, state machine that models how the SSH client interacts with the server. So we have to be kind of careful. So we have to find the safe place where we can run our code. And what you're aiming for in the choice of a safe place is really minimal deviation from the normal operation of the code. And funnily enough, right, that happens to be in the middle of the main line, of course, around the select call, because that's where everything branches from. So we read the find source. I find the select call. I decide that's probably a good place. So we ptrace attach. We stop the process. We drop a breakpoint in that safe place, and we let it run until it comes back. Just like that. But where is select? Normally, right? Normally, if you're debugging something, you just go, hey, GDB, where's select? And it goes, oh, yeah, over there. It's all good. But we don't have any symbol information, so we have to work backwards. And this technique is very well understood. Everyone does this sort of thing. So where does select come from? It comes from libc. So how does it get in there? Well, the loader puts it there. Where does it put it? It dynamically links it into address space. So we ask, where'd you dynamically link it? It says over here, that's all good. And then, you know, we have to rummage around in the global offset table, find it in there. The ELF procedure linkage table, another exciting piece of the ELF format. And then we rather boringly rummage through the code segment until we find a piece of code that calls that PLT entry. In this case, actually, it's quite easy because there is only one call to select in the whole damn binary. So we can put a breakpoint right in the middle of the ELF PLT. Save me a step. Nice. So yeah, now we've found select. So where are we going to put our evil code? Well, we're going to go and patch SSH session 2 open, which is a piece of code responsible for setting up a new virtual channel and asking the server to connect something to the end, be it a TCP socket, or in our case, a shell. Still no debug symbols, of course. Fortunately for us, there's a unique error string in there. It happens to bitch about the dupe failing, and that's the only occurrence of that string in the binary. So we rummage around, we find it in the read-only data section, and walk the code segment looking for calls to that. Right, now we know roughly where we are in this function. Nice and easy. So yeah, the evil code itself, right, it's going to overwrite the first half of the virtual channel setup code. We're going to save the registers, we're going to save the flags so we don't fuck things up too much. And then basically we're going to inject, it's shellcode, right, it looks like shellcode, same sort of thing, right? We're going to call socket, we're going to call connect, we're going to connect it back to wherever we happen to be listening, and then we're going to substitute it for the file handles that it's expecting to be a normal Unix TDY. I like Unix, it's cool. Let's see you do that in Windows where your WinSock sockets are different from your file. Ah, Jesus. And then we're going to leave the register set up just right so that the second half of the function runs perfectly. And for really no good reason at all, I'm using libc calls instead of kernel syscalls, which I could, but just, you know, a bit of variety. Sick of kernel syscalls, very boring. So why all the effort, right? Why do we go to so much effort to overwrite half a function? Wouldn't it be simpler to just have a piece of code which we've already compiled, which happens to set up virtual channels, and we'll just kind of copy it into its address space and run it, right? That would be a lot more straightforward. Yeah, it might be. But one of the really suck things about that is you have to link it by hand with no symbol information, right? Which, if you've tried, is not fun, right? That's not a fun game at all. And so I thought maybe it would be easier to just let the bottom half of the function, which contains all the symbol references, just let it be and inject stuff up the top to take advantage of that. It's particularly nasty for SSH because it has this whole kind of, you may remember from programming classes or whatever, this data-driven metaphor, which was popular kind of late 90s or something, where you have like wild arrays of function pointers and you just let the data index into them and yeesh. Right, that's pretty yuck to have to reverse engineer on the fly. It's especially tedious if you have to do it for every binary. In this case, we actually patch it up at runtime to make sure that the shellcode we have will run in this particular environment. And you'll see, actually, it's surprisingly successful. So what do we do? Well, we work backwards from that unique dupe error message we found. We find the appropriate place at the top of the function. We just kind of walk up until we see a function preamble. And then we learn a few bits and pieces, like how big the local stack is, and we patch in the command line parameter so it's user-friendly, and a few other bits and pieces that we discovered as we were doing our thing. And now we have a nice little piece of evil. So yeah, let's wedge it in. Back up the instruction pointer so we know where we were. Back up the old code that we're about to overwrite, stash it somewhere in memory. And then we go ahead and just inject our code. Now, it's going to take care of a few bits and pieces. We've got a breakpoint at the end to catch it when it's finished. What do you think we're going to do next? That guy over there, right? He's busy. He's playing Hunt the Wumpus, right? He's just doing his job. Right, that Wumpus, it's still going to kill him. And we got ourselves a shell. Just like that, transparent. Like, the user doesn't even notice, right? He sits there running something interactive. Shell pops out from underneath him, and he doesn't even notice. Sucks for him, huh? So maybe you're going to go home and jack yourself, right? So what are you going to do? How are you going to do it? How are you guys going to go home and hijack yourself some action? Well, it's pretty straightforward. What I did, and you don't have to do what I did, of course, is I wrote the hijack code in C first. Makes it nice and easy. Compiled it up and compiled it actually directly into SSH because I wanted to prove that you could have two shell sessions down in SSH, and you can. I hooked it up to like a magic keystroke in the you smack the escape tilde or whatever the hell it is, right, and bring up the command prompt, and I typed in, open me a shell, please, and it gave me one, right, just to prove the point. And then, of course, the compiler had conveniently generated most of my shell code for me. Gee, that was so hard. Glad I bought the book. And then I went ahead and implemented hijacking for a binary that had debug symbols. Make it nice and easy, just to prove that I get the code in and out of memory, in and out of the half of the function, nice and easily. And then the really suck bit, which is you build a list of symbols you're going to need to find, and you come up with a strategy to find them, and then you actually have to go ahead and write code to do it. And then, oh look, jack your friends, fun and profit. And then, if you're really nice, right, you package it up for the security consultants, put some 3D, some spinny round, a few little whoosh. Maybe do it in Flash, I don't know. Right, a few bits and pieces, right? The things that didn't fit in elsewhere. Think about how much you use SSH, right? You use it for SCP. You use it for CVS. You pipe stuff over SSH all the time. You have backup push. You have some CPIO or your AFIO or whatever the other home role backup solution you're using on Unix because you can't find a decent one. Yeah, it gets around, right? There's a lot of it. And yeah, this does work over SCP. And yeah, it does work over stuff over SSH. There's a few little wrinkles, but it works just fine. Actually, the code on your CD doesn't work just fine. The stuff I have right now does, and it'll be on, I guess, on blackhat.com or DEFCON or wherever they put this stuff after I've finished. But yeah, it does. It jacks SCP just fine. You'll notice in the client, right, you can hit, hit tilde, and then I think it's hash or something, and it brings up a list of the open virtual channels you have. Does it show up in that list? Yeah, it does, actually. How many of you knew you could list the virtual channels open with tilde and hash? One. Horns. Thank you. But, of course, that's the client that's listing it, so you want to go patch that? Sure, no problem. And what happens when they log out? Well, anyone who's used port forwarding, right, you know what happens when you've got an open shell, you've got a port forward as well, you're using the port forward to, you know, look at goat porn or whatever, right? And you log out, right? You haven't finished looking at the goat porn, the connection stays open. Great. Well, same thing happens here. So you're SCPing, your SCP takes 30 seconds, I happen to catch it in time, run a shell over it, your SCP will stay running once it's finished copying so that I can do some hacking, play Hunt the Wumpus. And how well does it work? Well, at the moment, any open SSH 3, it should work on. It's known to work on the out-of-the-box Debian Sarge, RHEL3, RH9. It works on Slack, Slackware as well, 9.1. It doesn't work on SUSE because their compiler is just retarded. I work with a guy who used to work at SUSE on their AMD 64 stuff, and they got paid by AMD to write loads of extra optimizations for AMD 64, and then they went and backported them over to Intel, and now the compiler just generates code that's so wildly broken, right? I look at it, right? I cannot believe it even executes, right? I've seen it miscompile like really basic stuff. Anyway, so it doesn't work on SUSE, right? I'll get around to it. Right? I'll probably just write some. One-off custom code that's going to work on SUSE, because the magic heuristic stuff that works on everything else doesn't work on their compiler. Silly SUSE. Also, it's also worth mentioning, I guess, Python 2.2, 2.3, 2.4 it's known to work with. 2.1 it ought to work, but I haven't tested on 2.1. Anything older than that, you're probably, there's a few bits and pieces that are broken. GDB, I haven't noticed any version it doesn't work with yet. It's a pretty straightforward text interface. Now, if you'll indulge me, a brief tangent into anti-forensics. Now, those of you who were at Black Hat or RuxCon last year may have seen the Grugs talk on anti-forensic stuff. I don't know if he was doing it at DEF CON. Was he? No. It's very interesting. Well, I saw it at RuxCon 2 years ago, or a year and a half ago. And he has a number of very interesting things to say about anti-forensics. And, of course, when you're attacking systems like this, right, in the middle of the day, or when everyone's using them, it assumes that you're taking pretty basic anti-forensic precautions. You don't want to leave too many trails. So, yeah, I'm going to talk just a brief, very brief overview of anti-forensic technique, and then how I've implemented it successfully and unsuccessfully in some places when I was using and writing the SSH jacket. So yeah, the most important thing is don't put anything on disk. Do it all in memory, right? Memory goes away when they reboot the box. Right? There's nothing on disk. There's no tripwire. There's nothing for them to look at with NCASE or whatever other expensive kind of forensic products they're using. You know, it sucks if you get swapped out the disk. You know, oh well. But really, you want to try and keep everything in memory only. Use local tools, right? These are Turing complete machines. You can write your exploit code in whatever's available, right? If you have to write a port scanner and ORC, do it, right? Right. If it has a Perl interpreter, great, use that. Right. If it has a Python interpreter, use that. If you're good, right, you turn up, you find what's there, and you write your tools on the spot. That way you don't have to go and, you know, wget magic hacksaw tarball.tar.gz from hacksaw.com, right, which is a real fucking giveaway. You don't want them to know what you did. And yeah, try not to make new network connections, right? You don't want anything for their intrusion detection or cough prevention systems to spot. And you don't want them sniffing your traffic and kind of replaying it later and figuring out what the hell you did. So yeah, reuse your existing connection, hide in plain sight, use encryption. So how well do I do? Well, we do use general purpose tools, right? GDB is pretty general purpose. I mean, if you turn up on a box that doesn't have GDB, maybe it's not such a giveaway to go ahead and install it, right? I mean, maybe you're just helping, right? You're just doing a bit of administration for them. Some of the best-run Windows boxes I've seen are admin by Russian hackers. Remotely, right? They don't even have to go inside to reboot it. How nice. So, yeah, we do. We use general-purpose tools. We use the Python interpreter. We use GDB. That's nice. SSH is encrypted, so the packet logs, not much use. Our new shell that's going across the existing SSH connection, right, there's nothing new there. There's no new connection for any intrusion detection or things to spot. nothing but interlog, right? Not very interesting. So that's good. We're looking okay so far. And yeah, where do I suck? Well, Python code lying around disk, not very elegant, right? I got to copy the script across, and then I got to go Python SSH jack, yada yada, yada, right? That's not very nice. There's a script lying around for them to look at. Even Python bytecode lying around, you can turn that back into code pretty easily. And of course, the other problem is we have that connection coming from the SSH client out to, you know, our netcat, which has a TCP connection with the shell on the other end, right? That's a new connection. That's not so nice. And yeah, it's in the clear as well. So obviously, if I were a cunning man, if I were a patient man, I would have implemented SSH connect back, right? Because all the code in the client is there, right? We could just SSH out. That would be nice. I haven't done that yet, sorry. But if you happen to turn up over SSH, right? So say it's the second box you've routed in a row, right? And you just came in across an SSH connection. Why don't you set up a port for it? Bring it back down like that. That would be a pretty good idea. So let's not leave our scripts lying around on disk. How about we just go ahead and load that Python directly into memory? All good, right? So let's just run up a Python interpreter, ask it to read from standard in, and execute it. And then locally, we'll take our Python script that we want to run remotely, we'll compile it up, we'll turn it into bytecode, we'll compress it in Base64, we'll send it across the wire. Maybe we'll have a little loader at the other end to unpack it and run it. And then send it across your shell. That's all good, right? Nothing on disk. That sounds straightforward to anybody? That's pretty straightforward to me, right? It's just three lines right there, and then a little bit of jiggery-pokery. All right, I know you want a script. You want scripts, don't you? Right? Okay, I wrote a script for you, make it nice and easy. It does all of the above, right? So math will load, you pass it a Python script, a list of Python libraries it might require, command line arguments, packs it up, sends it across, runs it. You give it a shell on the remote end, it knows how to do the rest. And then if you're really cool, right, hack and screen. Screen's really neat. Screen is a terminal multiplexer, right? You must know screen. Does anyone not know what screen is, right? Sorry. Very sorry, apologize. Screen has this really cool feature called bang. It'll run a local command and then a bunch of other options, but it will inject the output of that local command into your remote session. So I sit there on screen, I go control A, and the screen escape sequence. I go bang, 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 bang. Map a load, SSH jack, process ID, destination host and port, and it runs it on the remote machine, just like I was there. It's pretty cool, right? You can almost forget you're running it remotely. And obviously, for your convenience, that's on the CD. So what else could I do? What else could I do with this? Well, it will be nice to actually generate the shellcode on the fly, right, with an assembly. I didn't get around to writing an assembly yet, and other people have already written pretty good ones, even in Python, right, most dev. Doesn't have a lot of documentation, so I read through it, but yeah, I haven't implemented that yet, sorry. Yeah, pure Python debugger, that would be cool. What other protocols have virtual channel infrastructures and are used on clients? Lots. Especially poorly patched thin clients. MSIDP, Citrix. I've already had a chat with some people who like hacking on Citrix, and they're pretty keen on this idea. Right, Citrix has got a virtual channel infrastructure for running, you know, drive mapping and COM port mapping and all the other crazy shit that you pay money for. What's wrong with X, right? Yeah, and all manner of things, right? I mean, once you have an automated programmatic debugging toolkit, you start seeing all the things you can just beat with that hammer, right? It's a really cool thing to have in your toolkit. You can start, you know, you can have it disassemble stuff on the fly, figure stuff out and patch it, right? All programmatically, it's cool. Right, now being as it is that, you know, I'm obviously some sort of long hair, right? And I'm from the Antipodes, I'm not very fashionable, right? I'm kind of stuck in the 80s and shit, right? So, I'm not sure if this is still fashionable, right? Because, blaming Theo for everything. Is that still fashionable? Yeah? Yeah, okay. Unfortunately for me, it's not Theo's fault. Sorry. It's actually a feature of all things. Right, the SSH protocol specification says it's just fine to have multiple shells on the other end. In fact, it's a requirement. Right, that's pretty cool, huh? I mean, I hadn't really thought about it before, right? My SSH client, right? You type SSH, you get a shell. That's all there is to it, right? But now imagine like a graphical client, like a tabbed client where you have multiple shells. Why not, right? It's a good idea. So yeah, it's a feature, right? If you could get a shell from a server back to the client, right, that would be a bug. Unfortunately, FEO took care of that. He's good dude. Same with unsolicited port forwarding. If you could port forward from a server back to the client without it asking you to do so, that would be a bug also. But no, it's taken care of. Now, I haven't looked at any other SSH implementations. Because SSH is, you know, the client and the server are very, very similar in functionality. They both have to deal with this multiplexing and demultiplexing. Generally, most people write that code once, right, and use it in both the client and a server implementation. So you have to be pretty careful. So if I were you, and you're using a funny SSH server, like I don't know, one of those crazy Cisco ones, I don't know, I might have a look at that. It's funny if it worked, wouldn't it? But anyway, yeah, so it's not OpenSSH's fault. Please don't send the bug reports. It's not a bug. Blame me instead. I don't want Theo to, kind of ring me up and harass me, kick my ass or whatever. But yeah, OpenSSH is cool. For the record, OpenSSH is cool. I like it. It's a big, fat, bloated piece of crap, but I like it. I use it every day. Right, mitigation technique. Responsible slide right here. Don't get rooted. Nice and easy. You could, if you were coming, patch ptrace, maybe, so you couldn't do it as a user. Yeah, that'd work, I suppose. There's patches around to do that already. One of the things that's not on there is you could, the SSH agent, they try to prevent this attack by making it set GID. I don't know that making your SSH client set GID is a good idea. I mean, there's probably all sorts of other things that will go horribly wrong if you did that. One of the most important things that you can actually do to help yourself is if you're running restricted, they're running trust relationships using keys between hosts. There's a bunch of tools you can use to restrict what those keys can be used for. You can restrict what commands are executed. You can restrict where the port forwarding is allowed. You can restrict X forwarding, all that sort of thing. Use it. Use it. Really do. Oh, yeah, and then Steve Gibson, he had some really good ideas about those raw sockets right there. They're bad. Sorry, debuggers. I think we should get him in charge of the anti-debugger movement. Why do you care? It's just a party trick, right? This is just like keylogging but fast. That's all, right? It's not wildly zero-day. If you get rooted, you're screwed. You knew that. Rich desktops, yeah, it's a good way, right? Attacking desktop machines that are filled with complexity is a very good way to get the well-protected servers. And especially Linux admins. Anyone running Linux on the desktop is probably looking after interesting stuff. And yeah, try it against RDP or ICA. That could be interesting. Mad greets. There's not much of a scene in New Zealand. There's only a few of us. We all drink beer. There's like, we sit around two tables, the whole scene. But yeah, I thought I'd better say hi to them. And Ganu Spice, he gave me my first security book a few years ago. He's a good dude. Oh yeah, and there was a few talks at RuxCon that were interesting. The elf. Sean Clow's elf encryptor, right? That's some crazy shit, right? Go read that. It has like symbiotic, p-tracing processes that take memory in and out of each other and unencrypt. It's crazy. Go look at it. Apparently I'm out of time, so you don't get to shred me. Sorry. There was also a demo, but I'm getting the death signal. So if you want to see a demo, come see me afterwards. We'll do it on a box that doesn't look like a screensaver. And thank you, guys.